This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of November the 1st, 2021, brought to you by Taft. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Regular listeners of the podcast know that we've been developing a theme over the last several months. What has happened to the workforce, the employees that businesses and our economy depend on? Now, of course, we're in the midst of a labor shortage in many industries that I think we can safely say began developing well before the pandemic. Last week, we spoke with Pete the Planner about the Great Resignation, this lengthening wave of folks quitting their jobs. Earlier this year, we discussed how restaurants are struggling to find workers. We've spoken with workers who've been laid off or who have had to make big adjustments to keep doing their jobs. Well, today we're going to take in the overhead view from the top of the dome of the Indiana State House. Our guest is Fred Payne, the commissioner of Indiana's Department of Workforce Development. Now, I do on occasion write about state workforce issues for IBJ, and there have been a number of things that I have been dying to discuss. For example, we know that Indiana's official unemployment rate is back down to 4% after being in the double digits last year. But at the same time, we know that more than a third of Hoosiers of working age are not employed. Now, here's a quick spoiler. That second figure is related to the workforce participation rate, and that has not rebounded since the dark days of the pandemic, and in fact, it's been on the decline at least since the year 2000. Now, Commissioner Payne addresses some of the more persistent questions, such as which industries are suffering the most intense labor shortages, and whether the discontinuation of federal unemployment benefits in early September pushed a significant portion of people back into the job market. Commissioner Payne explains what the state is doing to help Hoosiers get back to work. And I try to get his take on whether the state should raise its minimum wage, which for years has matched the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. We should note that three of the four states adjacent to Indiana are now above $7.25. All right, here's our conversation. I'm pleased to welcome to the podcast Fred Payne, Commissioner of Indiana's Department of Workforce Development. Thank you for taking the time to join us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to talk about the labor shortage that the entire nation is experiencing, and I want to look at it from Indiana's perspective. But first, as a warning to the listeners, I have a preamble about the unemployment rate to make sure I understand what it means and where we are. So everybody put on your hip waders. We're going to talk about statistics for a second. In the really dark days of the pandemic, in April 2020, the unemployment rate, which had been, I think, around the 3 to 4%, then shot up in April 2020 to 16.9%. Now then we'll fast forward to September of this year, just last month, Indiana had an unemployment rate of 4%. And that brings us back to that neighborhood that we were in before the pandemic. And we should say the percentage is better than the national unemployment rate in September, which was 4.8%. Am I right so far?
You are hitting the nail right on the head on each one of those.
Okay. Now, 4% sounds great. But to my understanding, there's a caveat here in the way that we calculate the percentage. When you count the number of unemployed Hoosiers to get that percentage, you're using the definition of unemployed people, meaning those who don't have a job but are looking for work. So that does not take into account the people who are not employed and have decided not to look for work or for whatever reason are not looking for work. So for example, if I decide to quit my job and become a stay-at-home dad, which is a longtime dream of mine, I would not be reflected in that unemployment percentage. Is that right?
Right. You would be considered someone who's not in the labor participation rate because you are not participating in the labor force. That's correct.
Right. Or if I was fired at the beginning of the pandemic and I've given up looking for a job because I'm in journalism and there are no jobs out there, I would not be reflected in the unemployment percentage because I'm not looking for a job.
Now, again, the thing that we focus on here is the participation rate. We want to make sure that we're counting people who are participating, but we also want to make sure that we are counting the total population out there at large, which is obviously a key part of this as well. And you had mentioned, and I want to kind of go off a little bit of what you said, that we're now back at, we're at 4.0%, which is kind of close to where we were pre-pandemic at 3.2%. We've had 10 consecutive months a 4.6 or below unemployment rate. Now, what we're looking at there now is that we see that there's sort of a, and I'm going to use the word stabilizing, and I'm using it in air quotes if you were able to see me. And what I mean by stabilizing is that there isn't this big jump from 4.0 to 8% or down from 4.0 to 2%. So we're not seeing that right now. And that's not something that we expect to see. If you recall, as you mentioned, back in April, we had that 16.9%. It shot up dramatically from 3%, you know, over the previous month. We're not seeing that type of volatility in the unemployment rate right now. What people are seeing, though, is the what I'm calling sort of the churn, and that's where people are leaving jobs. We're seeing a lot of volatility there. And the interesting thing about that is that people are leaving jobs, but they're immediately looking for another job. So it's not as if there's this big group of people who are leaving jobs and going and sitting at home. And that lets us know that either they're looking for a new opportunity, they have either received some training or education that has given them the skills to get another job, so they're changing careers. And then you have a few different varieties of things that people are doing when they end up leaving the workforce.
While we're talking about it, is there anything that we can say about the people who are deciding to quit their jobs and look for new work? Does it tend to be a particular kind of employee, or is it across the board?
It's pretty much across the board. The one thing that we're finding in some of the data that we're looking at is that there's no one single category of people that can that we can, you know, spread it across the board. We have individuals who have moved out of the service industry, who've gotten training, and they're moving into a different type of job. They're moving into maybe IT, or they're moving into some other type of service type of job. We have individuals who were in any other field. We're seeing a lot of growth in the IT area. We're seeing a lot of growth in coding, computer coding, and things like that. People who are going into those fields come from a variety of backgrounds. So we're not really seeing, you know, type A only move into type B. We're seeing, you know, a variety of movement with a variety of different people.
So let me jump back real quick to the unemployment rate. So when we say there's 4% unemployment, we shouldn't interpret that as all but 4% of adults of working age in Indiana don't have a job.
You're correct.
And I want to insert parenthetically here, if we're just talking about the Hoosiers who are unemployed and looking for work, that number in September was an estimated about 135,000.
Right, a little bit shy of that.
And that was down from close to 138,000 in July.
Yes.
So the reason why I went through all of that, I want to also make clear that when people see that 4% figure, I think some of them assume that, well, we must be close to the point where all the jobs that are open are close to being filled. They must think, well, how could there be a labor shortage if we're at 4% unemployment? But the unemployment rate doesn't necessarily correspond with whether businesses are filling their open positions.
That's correct.
So when we say Indiana, like every other state, is experiencing a labor shortage, what do we mean? What's happening?
What we really mean by that is that employers are actually finding difficulties to fill the open job positions that they have. Doesn't mean that people are not out filling jobs in total, but in specific industries overall, employers are having difficulty filling all of the open positions that they have.
Now, what industries are experiencing the most need?
Actually, it's across the board. I can give you several, particularly right now. The service industry is continuing to be hit hard. Hospitality industry is being hit particularly hard. Healthcare is continuing to grow, and they are still having some difficulty finding different types of workers. And then even on the manufacturing side, you may have employers who are finding difficulty with entry-level employees.
If we just look at manufacturing, since that's a huge part of our economy, why are they having trouble finding entry-level employees?
Some of it is geographic-based. Some of it is, you know, skills-based, because even though they're entry-level employees, there is a certain skill level that the employers want them to have that they may not have already. And then employability skills, like being able to understand the flow of processes, understand certain reading and writing and math and equations like that, that play a big part in manufacturing. So employers do find it difficult to find some employees on the entry level, and some what they call the skills-based levels, they're having a problem with those too.
The industry that is most visible to us, I think, is the service industry, because, you know, we all head into restaurants and everywhere we go, we see signs that say we're hiring. And, you know, and our restaurants are closing early or are not open at all because they can't find people. And I've just been fascinated by this. What do we know about the people who had been working in the service industry who are no longer? What happened to them?
We have to look at the service industry a little differently now than we did prior to 2020. So we looked at the service industry sort of as individuals who were in a restaurant and they were serving meals and they were a part of that whole process. Now, obviously, there's a shortage of individuals who are in the service industry right now as that existed before. What we are finding is that some of those individuals are still in the service industry, but they're taking different types of service industry jobs. Here's the example. You may have a person who was a server at restaurant X. Now they are working for Uber Eats, DoorDash. They're still in the service industry, but they're not necessarily having that face-to-face and direct contact with the customers as they would in a restaurant, but still the service industry. Those restaurants, those companies like that, they have changed the way that they do business. You know, once upon a time, there are certain restaurants that never would have thought about having curbside delivery, having takeout and things of that nature. COVID obviously changed that, and they are capitalizing on the delivery service. And what employers who are in the service industry who may not have liked those, you know, face-to-face jobs, they still are in the service industry, but it's a different type of job in the service industry.
Okay, let's take a quick break to gather our thoughts and to welcome our new sponsor, Taft. This is the IBJ Podcast.
Taft, today's modern law firm. With more than 625 attorneys across 11 offices, we provide solutions to the business issues facing middle market and emerging companies alike. We do this through a highly collaborative and inclusive team approach. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. We're joined by Fred Payne, the Commissioner of Indiana's Department of Workforce Development.
When we talk about folks who have left the workforce or are not looking for jobs, what can we say about them? Are there any commonalities there?
I think so. I'm going to give you a few categories of people who've left the workforce, and then we'll talk about the ones who are re-entering, okay? The group of people who've left the workforce, they come in a lot of different varieties. And what COVID-19 did over the past 18 months is made people reimagine and rethink what their priorities are. So, for example, if you may have had a two-income household couple, right, and they had small children, one of those persons was displaced during COVID. They realized that during COVID, that even though they may have received some type of unemployment benefit for a fixed duration of time, they were receiving less money in their household because it's not two incomes. However, they realized also that some of maybe the stress that they had with trying to get child A and child B to different locations and all that comes along with rearing children, that it was a little bit more comfortable for them with one parent doing that, even if the household received less income. And they realized that they could get by on less. And they've made a conscious decision that one of the persons in the household was going to leave the workforce. So you're having more of that than it happened in 2019 because people were forced to see it. They were forced to feel it. And so that's one group of people. Those individuals will eventually come back to the workforce by and large. Then you have another group of individuals who were maybe displaced and realized that the type of education and skills that they had didn't allow them to have a job that allowed them to go remote, that allowed them the flexibility that they needed to withstand this type of environment that we were in. So they've made a conscious decision that they're going to change their education status or their training status. And some of them have taken advantage of the state programs that we have in place that have helped to defray cost and that have provided some education and training for individuals in the state. So they've taken advantage of that. But some of them have not re-entered the workforce yet for a couple of reasons. One, because they're still taking the training and education. The other one is that they're taking their time to choose the career that they want to go into instead of accepting the first job that's offered to them. They have realized that you know, being in a job that I like, being in a job that I feel that I have some growth and this is a career and not just a job, they're willing to wait for that right opportunity. Then you have the individuals who were close to retirement. They didn't really want to retire yet. They still had a few more years to work that they wanted to work. But for a variety of reasons, they've accelerated their retirement. And so they're out of the workforce. It could have been for health reasons. It could have been, you know, maybe to help another family member, maybe a child, grandchild, or someone like that. So you have those people who have left the workforce. And we've seen that the people who are leaving the workforce, people who are over the age of 45, have been leaving at a higher rate than those who are not over the past 18 months.
Now, I think that there was a hope that when the federal pandemic unemployment benefits were discontinued in early September, more workers would start pursuing these open jobs and the labor crunch would ease up. What are you seeing at your 50,000 foot level? Is that what happened? Was there a rush of people back into the workforce trying to look for jobs because they no longer were getting benefits?
Well, the data, the numbers don't bear that out completely, but it's difficult to say that the federal benefits had no impact because they probably had a bigger impact earlier on when the enhanced benefit was double what it was, you know, that ended in September. And you had an entire group of workers who were never contemplated receiving unemployment benefits than ever before. You had gig workers, you had independent contractors, and even people who did not have enough money built into the enough wages to qualify for unemployment who are eligible. So you had that entire group of people who were receiving benefits. However, the data that we've seen did not show that there's this wholesale, you know, turn of employees, returning into the work environment. But we did see a little bit of a bump in some independent trade association surveys when the benefits were talked about going away, that they did see amongst their members that they had a higher number of applicants during a short period. That's just a small group of people. In terms of the enhanced benefits revolutionizing employees getting back to work, we didn't see that happen. But what we have seen in some additional data is that individuals, you know, banking and checking accounts have been a little bit higher than they were this time last year and the previous years. So that's provided individuals with a little bit of cushion who may have an unemployed person in the house or they themselves may be unemployed. And it's given them an opportunity to, you know, spend a little bit more time looking for that job that they want to have. The question that I get quite often is, well, what are we going to do about this labor shortage? Well, first, there's no silver bullet, because if there was, any one of us in my role across the country would have loaded our gun and shot that bullet already. So it's going to take a variety of things. And some of the questions that we get quite often is, well, what is the state doing to help this shortage? And we're doing a variety of things because we know that we have to do it. We have to hit this on all fronts. One is we're having some direct engagement with those who are unemployed. So we've created a system now. If a person applies for unemployment, we can give specific outreach based upon their characteristics, their educational background, their certification background. So we're giving them outreach that's specific to that person. It's not just some generalized outreach. So that's one thing. The other thing is we've made sure that we provided some enhanced training opportunities for individuals under the governor's Next Level Jobs program. So first, we have Next Level Job, under the Next Level Jobs program, we have what we call the Workforce Ready Grant Program. And that's a program where we have a variety of educational and training providers throughout the state who are signed up. And if individual X wants to change their career and go into computer coding, they go to nextleveljobs.org. They find a trainer or an education institution that provides that training. They sign up for it. We cover the cost of that. Then on the employer side, we have what we call the employer training grant. And the employer training grant is to help employers to train, retrain, or hire employees. And that program provides $5,000 for individual employees to get the training or retraining that they need, up to $50,000 per employer. Because we know that the financial barrier is one of the things that keeps people from getting more educational training. The third thing is that we're making sure that we're deepening our relationships and our engagement with employers and with educators. On the employer side, It lets us know what jobs are available and what jobs are emerging. We know some of those jobs that we think about that will be here 2-3 years from now, they're not here now. But employers know that they're in a process of creating those jobs or creating processes for them. So we get that information, we engage with the educational institutions and let them know what's on the horizon. They can end up developing training to make sure that the people are getting trained on something that's not going to be antiquated. So the employer relationship and the educational relationships that we have throughout the state are so important. And so we think that a combination of those things, and we're doing much more than that, but I wanted to make sure that at least in the time that we have, mentioned some of those things that we're doing.
At this point, how do you measure whether or not these are working?
A couple of things. One, we can see from an individual standpoint that a person is moving from, you know, job X that was making a wage that, that now they're making a higher wage. So that is helping the person with their own economic mobility. So that's one of the ways that we define success in that. On the employer side, what we're seeing is that there are a greater number of individuals who are being trained. And this is where we may see a little bit of the churn. So you may have an individual who now wants to move to another job. Well, they can now move to that other job, even at another company, because now they have enhanced skills and they have some enhanced training. One of the things that we have to be careful about and that we're paying particular attention to is that there are individuals who are on the sidelines who are out of the workforce right now. And we are making sure that we have specific ways that we do outreach to them. As I mentioned, we have a specific way of doing outreach to the person who's unemployed and who files for unemployment. But then there's the individual who may not have been in the employment arena for a while. So we're trying a variety of things and trying to meet the person where they are, whether that's with, you know, one of our local workforce development boards, going into gymnasiums and engaging with people there to try to make sure that if there are some people who are not working, that now they know about the opportunities that are available to them. One statistic that I do want to make sure that I mention here is called the re-entrance. What we've seen over the past few months is that we are having an increasing number of re-entry people. And what I mean by that is these are individuals who were once employed and they were once a part of the labor force, but for whatever reason, they were not a part of the labor force for a specific period of time. And now they're currently seeking employment. I see that as a leading indicator that our labor participation rate will continue to, it will increase because those are people who are returning to the workforce. And some of them, quite frankly, could be, you know, the second spouse in a household who ended up leaving the workforce for family reasons, or you have someone who left the workforce to take care of an aging parent.
Can you give me a raw number of people who fall under that designation, people who have re-entered the workforce?
Well, that I can't give you that because the chart that I looked at, it gives me the graph, but it doesn't have the number on it. But I can follow up with you and tell you what that specific number is.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up labor force participation rate, because that's the second statistics that I'm really fascinated by. The labor force participation rate, the way I understand it, is this is a percentage of all people of working age who are employed or are actively seeking work. And this is where we get a better sense of how many people of working age, but for whatever reason, are not looking for work. And you went through some of those. So in September, the labor force participation rate was 63%. So 63% of Hoosiers of working age are either employed or are actively seeking work. And that was down from 64.5 in late 2019. And if you want to look at it long-term, it was 68% in early 2001, and it's been declining ever since. Now, that doesn't seem like a healthy trend. What's happening there? Why has it been on such a long-term decline?
Sure, that's a good question. First, Indiana's labor participation rate, even though it's a little bit lower than it has been over in previous years, it is higher than a national rate. So from how we compare nationwide, we're still above what the national rate is. There have been a lot of reasons for the labor participation rate to take a dip. Again, part of it is the way people are viewing work now. They didn't view it that way 20 years ago. Right now, we'll talk raw numbers on what our labor force is. So in September, our labor force was, you know, 3.34 million. In August, it was about the same. But when we look back at this time last year, we had fewer people. And even prior to, we had fewer people who were in the labor force. So even though the participation rate may have taken a percentage point dip, what we are seeing is that the people who are actually in the labor force, we are seeing signs of increase because it is increasing. To me, that's another leading indicator that that labor participation rate will eventually change. Over the past few months, we've seen a swing from, you know, 0.2 or 0.1 percentage point. And it's going to continue to happen for the next few months. It's going to have that small swing. We're not going to see a big 2%, 3% swing over the next few months. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that with some of the leading indicators that I mentioned earlier, that we should probably start seeing that number go up a little bit. It's going to be in increments because, again, people are viewing work a lot differently. And one thing that we don't have a good grasp of right now, particularly with our agency, and it's because of the way wages are reported. As I talked to you earlier about the service industry and how people are moving toward the gig economy and moving toward DoorDash and Uber Eats and things like that. So what we have is we can track a person who has W-2 wages because we get that data here. And we can tell you how many people we have who's doing those jobs and who's changed. But what we don't have is we don't receive the wage data for a person who's in a gig economy, right? The person who drives for Uber, that type of person. So there's a small percentage, well, it's not even a small percentage. There's a percentage of people out there right now that we don't have data for. And because things have changed in the economy so quickly, we're trying to catch up with that gig economy. So even though our labor participation rate may be what it is, and even our labor force, there's still probably a pocket of people out there that we're not capturing.
Indiana's minimum wage is $7.25 or $7.25 per hour, which my understanding, that's as low as it could possibly go because that's the federal minimum. Is that right?
Yes.
Now, I'll compare that to our neighboring states. In Illinois, it's $11. In Ohio, it's $8.80. In Michigan, it's $9.65. And in Kentucky, they're with us, it's $7.25. So many states in recent years have increased their minimum wages. In fact, more than 20 increased their minimum wages between just last year and this year. Obviously, it's a hot topic in the national stage in terms of income equity. You can make the argument that a higher minimum wage could attract more workers to the state. So let's say I am an Indiana legislator and I'm turning to Fred Payne and I want your advice. I want to know what is your recommendation in terms of raising the minimum wage in Indiana?
Well, one, I'm not going to give a recommendation, okay, because there's data on either side of that argument, okay? But I'll tell you what I see. What I see right now is that when you look at jobs that have historically been minimum wage jobs, and there's you're seeing help wanted signs, and you're seeing at a place like maybe a McDonald's or a fast food place, they're now offering jobs at $12, $13, $14, $16 an hour. There's an argument to be made that the market is taking care of that, that the market is moving toward, you know, we need to pay a wage that's going to attract people and that's going to keep people. And the minimum wage, when it comes to that dollar amount, whether or not that's going to be, you know, something that's going to entice a person to work at a particular job, that's data that, you know, quite frankly, I haven't seen it. Again, there's arguments on both sides of it. What I am seeing right now is that a lot of the industries that were low wage industries are increasing their pay on their own. So there's an argument to be made, you know, that the market is doing it for us. While at the same time, I do see that there are people who will provide you with maybe some data on the other side of that. If I'm talking to a legislator, what I would do is provide them with the statistics and the data that I have, and I would provide that to anyone who asks me for it.
Using the economist side of your brain, what do you think the effect of raising it to, let's say, $9 an hour would be?
Well, it's kind of hard to say because we've seen now that even with increased wages in the environment that we're in, we're still having labor shortages. So there could be an argument that it could have minimal or no effect on it because, again, we're seeing those increased wages now. That would really be the economist side of me. That's the data that I have.
I'm nowhere near being an economist. The argument that I often hear for raising the minimum wage is not just would it raise that bottom layer of pay, the folks at $7.25, but it would have the effect of also incentivizing employers to raise the next layers, the people who get, let's say, the $9 an hour, the $10 an hour. Is that a legitimate theory? Is that what we see what happens if we raise the minimum wage?
Well, that's a theory.
Would you expect that to happen?
You know, that's one of those, you know, all tides rise types of theories. And when you have one layer of people who are going to get it increase, you know, it moves up to the other layer. So there's that theory. But I think one of the things that we have to look at when we talk about jobs that actually pay minimum wage, we have to look at them as being what they are. They are transient jobs. And sometimes you may hear the argument that, well, having a minimum wage job will not support a family. Well, a lot of those jobs were not designed to support a family. They are transient jobs, meaning that people take those jobs with the intent of only having them for a short period of time, not the type of job that they will have over the course of a career of 10, 15 years. So I think in that whole debate about raising the minimum wage in certain jobs, I think there has to be an acknowledgement of just what those minimum wage jobs are, what they were designed to be.
And I'll let you go here, but thank you so much for taking the time to explain all this to me and giving me this kind of perspective.
Well, Mason, I've enjoyed my time with you, but before I leave, I have to make sure that I do direct employers and let them know that there are some things that they can do on individuals that they can do, kind of help move the economy forward. One of the things that I mentioned earlier was next level jobs. One of the things that employers can do to help themselves and to help individuals is they can go on to what we call the Hoosier Talent Network. And our Hoosier Talent Network is sort of our artificial intelligence job matching platform. And what we need right now is more employers to be engaged in that. We have about 52,000 employees who are engaged in it. We just opened the employer portal for employers to sign up. And this is where you have the artificial intelligence taking a person's competencies, matching them with open jobs, not just a job board that says you have, you know, this experience, that experience, and that job over there is open, now go to it. It's a specific job matching tool. And so we need more employers to be engaged in that. And so that's one way that employers can get the specific employees that they need. The other thing that individuals can do to really help move this economy along and actually help themselves and others in their community and those that they love to move forward and to get some economic mobility is to ensure that they are taking advantage of the training and education that's available, whether it's through us or through one of the other educational institutions. The one thing that we know that is true is that education and training, they are the superhighway. They are the highway to everything that an individual wants to do in terms of economic mobility, utilizing their skills to a degree that they have some type of satisfaction. So I would encourage individuals to go to nextleveljobs.org and take advantage of some of those resources.
Well, again, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. This has been really fun. Thanks, Mason. You have a good rest of your day.
My thanks again to Fred Payne. And folks, before you get on with the rest of your week, I want to direct your attention to this week's issue of IBJ and a few of our top stories. Now, first up, insurers in Indiana, like in much of the nation, are pushing hard to boost membership in their Medicare Advantage plans, one of the fastest growing segments of the industry. John Russell explains how they're scrambling to sign up seniors before the December 7th enrollment deadline. Also in this issue, Emily Ketterer examines the pressure building in the Indiana State House for legalizing marijuana. And Leslie Bonilla Muniz details plans for the first Black-led community development financial institution in Indianapolis. Now again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say, it's quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business, community, and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.